Now we're speaking at the end of the last hour about D, the reign of Edward VI. Now, of course, the name of Edward VI is only a title for this period because he was a little boy from the age of 10 to 16 during this time. But his becoming king meant the removal of the strong hand of his father, Henry VIII, who really was personally devoted to the superstitions of the Middle Ages, and in his last few years tried to enforce them. But in the earlier periods of his reign, he had, in order to get the divorce he wanted and to get the freedom from papal control that he wanted, he had allowed the reformers to come in, and he had given some of them important places in his government, and had allowed the Bible to become distributed, and he was too good a politician to just suddenly completely change. But in his last few years, he introduced new laws which reestablished many of the superstitions of the Middle Ages, and even burned a few people at the stake for refusing to accept these. However, he had men important in his government like Cranmer, who had done much for him and for whom he had great regard, and he did not wish to turn against all of them, especially as he had no others he could trust to put in their places who were so devoted to him. He liked the idea of being head of the church, but it's questionable if he had lived another 40 years how much Protestantism would have been left in England. But when Henry died and the little boy became king, the majority of the Council of Regency that Henry had designated to rule during the minority of his son were, the majority were Protestants. And freed of Henry's control, they moved very easily in a Protestant direction. Now, in England at this time, you cannot say that the bulk of the people were Protestants. In fact, the overwhelming majority of the people, if you had asked them what they were, would have held to the old superstitions, undoubtedly. But the majority of the people in England were quite uneducated at this time. The majority of them were busy on their farms or in their handcrafts and other work, and they were loyal to their king, and they had been disgusted at the exactions the Pope had been making from them. The monasteries, which had been a great center for spiritual life and for general beneficence 2 centuries before, had been falling more and more into corruption. So probably the bulk of the people were rather glad to see these monasteries disappear. And that was a change. That is, the buildings didn't disappear, but as monasteries they disappeared. They now were private homes or private estates. And probably comparatively few of the people had any desire to see monastic life restored, and that was what had had the most direct effect upon the people. There was the church as a whole in Europe was so corrupt at this time that, as we noticed in Denmark and other countries, there were very few who were equipped to make a good argument for the established system. Most of the great many were living in corruption. This is the way we've done it. This is the way it should be done. The Pope's ahead. We should obey him. But when it came to making a good argument or to really having much understanding, most of them did not. Early in Edward's reign, one of his bishops sent representatives to make a visitation in his area to examine all of the priests in the area. They had maybe 300 village priests in the area. And he found that of those 300, half of them didn't even know who had spoken the Beatitudes. A third of them didn't know who had given the Lord's Prayer. And the ignorance of the priest was quite appalling. They were receiving their salary and going through a certain amount of mumbo-jumbo, the form and the ceremony. That was the general corrupt situation in which the church had fallen in so many parts of Europe. But the people in England who were active and pushing ahead, engaging in business and in studies and moving forward, a comparatively small part of the people, and yet a sizable number of people, they had been reading Luther's work. They had been having association with Protestants from the continent. Many of them had completely given up belief in the old superstition and were interested in having a vital Christianity. And the result was that when Henry's strong arm was removed, there was a surge in England among the thinking people, that is the educated class of people, among them and among the people in official positions, there was a surge in a Protestant right. Now this surge did not affect to any great extent the nobility. The bulk of the nobility at this time, that is the hereditary nobility, not people who had recently been made noble. But the bulk of the hereditary nobility had their own chapels in which they would have priests who were above the average in education and training. They knew a little bit about theology. Their tendency was to have a considerable loyalty to the established system. But the officials in the government, to a large extent, being Protestant-minded, and a great many of the thinking classes having a great desire to have a real living Christianity in the country, and Cranmer being the guardian of the young boy and the head of the Church of England, they immediately invited reformers from abroad to come and to help in pushing forward with Christianity in England. And so, Martin Buster, for one, you remember Martin Buster, who was a Dominican monk, but heard Luther speak in 1518 when Luther appeared before the Augustinian group in Heidelberg. Martin Buster there had become a follower of Luther and had left his Dominican order. He later was the head of the church in Strasbourg when Calvin was there and had the little French church there. Martin Buther was brought over to England to become a professor in the university. And so were Italian Protestant leaders and one great Polish Protestant leader. A number of fine Protestant leaders were brought to England at the royal invitation. John Knox, we mentioned already, a Scottish reformer who had been captured by the French and was a galley slave to the French. The English government got the French government to release him. I don't know whether they made an exchange for him or what they did, but they got them to release him to England, and Cranmer sent him to a region in the north of England where he would have a large area in which to preach and to spread the knowledge of Christ. Then another act that very soon done was to repeal all the laws for punishment of heresy. That is to say, the laws for killing people for heresy. They were immediately repealed by the Parliament, the first Parliament that met in Edward's sixth reign. They repealed the old statutes that had been in existence for 200 or 300 years for the burning of heretics. They repealed all of Henry VIII's laws for executing those who refused to follow his idea of what religion should be. All of these repressive laws were repealed by Edward's Parliament. They declared they wished people to come to know the truth and to follow it because they desired to, not because they were compelled. Then in 1549, a prayer book was prepared largely by Cranmer, much of it taken from old forms of the church through the Middle Ages. Beautiful forms in Latin, which he translated into wonderful English. He had a marvelous gift of English Scottish. And he translated them, making such changes as were at any point where the doctrine seemed to be wrong, and adding other sections himself. He prepared this prayer book in 1549, and it was ordered that this prayer book be used in all the churches in England. And the writings of men like Luther and Calvin, Melanchthon, and others was translated into English and published and distributed in England. In 1552, Cranmer got out a revised edition of the prayer book. During these 3 years, he had been reading a great deal of Calvin's writings. And the prayer book of 1552 was far more affected by Calvin's writings than the previous one had been. And during this time, a great many of the priests became married, because the laws against marriage of the clergy were entirely done away with at this time. Then there was prepared a doctrinal statement, 42 articles of religion. This was prepared and adopted, and the clergy were expected all to accept these 42 articles. One of the outstanding reformers in the reign of Edward VI was a man named John Hooper. They go O-P-E-R. John Hooper had been a monk, it is believed. We don't know much about his early life. Attempts have been made to find out about it. He does not seem to have had any special prominence during Henry VIII's reign, as some of the others said. But during the latter years of Henry VIII's reign, he was on the continent, where he met the continental reformers, studied with them and talked with them. Coming to England shortly after the beginning of Edward VI's reign, his abilities were recognized and he was invited to become a bishop. But Hooper had great qualms of conscience. Should he put on all the vestments and robes that the bishop was supposed to wear anyway? Should you have a bishop? Should not the people of the church choose their minister rather than to have a bishop? And so Hooper wrote to Calvin, for whom he had great admiration and esteem. He wrote to Calvin in Geneva, and he asked Calvin, should I accept the position of bishop? And Calvin wrote him back and said, there are certain matters of religion which are vital. The deity of Christ, the atonement of Christ, the only means of salvation from sin, salvation by faith, the absolute integrity of Scripture. These matters are vital. No compromise whatever can be made on these matters. But then Calvin said to Hooper, he said, the duty of the Christian is to spread these great doctrines in every possible way, to do everything he can to advance it. Now, he said, the system of government where you have the people electing their representatives and these representatives deciding the affairs of the church, he said, this is a far preferable system. It is more in line with scriptural teaching than having a bishop who has control. But, he said, it is not an anti-Christian thing for the church to be ruled in the system of bishops. And therefore, he said, if you have a chance to become a bishop and have opportunities to spread the gospel in that way, he said, you would be doing wrong to refuse to take advantage of the opportunity. And he said to Hooper, he said, I don't blame you for not wanting to put all this folder all wearing all these colored garments and all this, but he said, why should you let a little colored garment stand in the way of a chance to preach the gospel? So Hooper accepted the position of bishop, and during these 6 years, he had a great influence in his area in spreading the word of God. But then, during the last 2 or 3 years of Edward VI's reign, the little boy was in bad health, and it was very obvious that he had tuberculosis. And in those days, they did not have premasectomy or any of the other methods that have been worked out now of helping tuberculosis patients. They didn't even know how it was spread. They did not have the means of helping we have now. People knew the boy was not going to last many years. And finally, in 1553, when it was evident that his last stages were upon him, the Protestant leaders naturally were thrown into confusion. Because they knew that according to Henry VIII's will, the first one to succeed him was to be his son. But if the son should die without a descendant, then it was to be the oldest daughter, Mary. And after Mary, who next would be Elizabeth, and then the descendants of his oldest sister, Margaret, who had married the King of Scotland, and then the descendants of his younger sister, Mary, who after a brief time married to an elderly King of France, had come back to England and married an English duke and had some grandchildren living. Now, the Mary, the next one in line, was the daughter of Catherine, whom Henry had so mistreated. Yes, sir. Well, as far as the present situation is concerned, we say Mary the next in line, and these others come after. Now, I'll refer to it again later on. I will go through it later on. But for now, the thing I want to have in mind that Mary is next, there's no question of that, and that the descendants of his youngest sister are way down the line. That's the main thing we want right now. Now, Mary was already a girl in her teens when Henry had desired to get rid of her mother. And Mary had been raised by her mother. Her mother was an ardent Romanist. She was a Spanish in her background and her viewpoint. The daughter was raised by the mother, very devoted to the mother, felt, as most of the English people felt, that her mother had been very wrongly treated. Then Henry had removed her from being with her mother even, and made her be a lady-in-waiting to the little baby Elizabeth. And then when Elizabeth also fell out of favor when Edward was born, they were both of them pretty much secondary to Edward, but Mary was old enough to know what it was all about. And she hated Bishop Cranmer, because she knew Cranmer was the one who had advised her father to declare that he was the supreme head of the Church of England. And she knew that Cranmer, as Archbishop of Canterbury, had given the decision that Henry was divorced from Catherine. She hated Cranmer. She was very anxious to re-establish Romanism in England. And she was next in line. Well, what should be done under these circumstances? Well, they had a situation then which is difficult for most of us to imagine, because we've never gone through a period like the Wars of the Roses. None of these people had now, but their parents had, or at least their grandparents, and they'd heard how a century before armies marched back and forth across England. As this man said, "I am the descendant of Edward III who's entitled to be King of England." And this other one said, "I'm the one who's entitled to be King of England." And they fought back and forth, and hundreds of the common people were massacred as the armies went back and forth and had their property stolen to support the army. And when Henry VII got control, the people were so happy to have peace and order in the country. And so now, the bulk of the English people, the thing they wanted above all was to have a ruler that everybody recognized as the ruler and have law and order. And everybody recognized Mary was next in line for the throne. Well, there was I don't want to go into any details about the plot that was made now. It's a little aside from our important developments of church history. I just wanted to refer to the fact that there was a plot to prevent Mary from becoming queen, and this plot was made by one of the Council of Regency, who had been ingratiating himself more and more into the heart of the young king. And this man took the grandchild of Henry's youngest sister, Mary, who was a young girl, about 17, a brilliant young girl, a very ardent Protestant, Jane Grey. And he said, "This girl, who's a very ardent Protestant, and who's highly educated, one of the few girls in history of her age who have been as intelligent and well-educated and as earnest Christian as Jane Grey was." And he said, "Jane Grey we ought to have queen. Instead of Mary, this one who will bring back Romanism and destroy Protestantism, or Elizabeth, who seems rather lukewarm, and the little girl didn't seem to have any special interest in religion anyway, and he said, let's pass over both of them and get Jane Grey." Well, I don't know whether he ever would have succeeded in it or not, but he immediately married Jane Grey to his own oldest son. And of course, that marked it as a political scheme immediately in the eyes of most people to get his son into power. Well, he kept secret for two or three days after Edward's death the fact he died, while they brought Jane Grey and his son and crowned her as Queen of England. But once the word came out, the majority of the people flocked to Mary. They said, "You're the next one in line. You're the legitimate queen. We don't want fighting back and forth over who's the ruler. Nobody has the right to pass over all these others in the line and go down to Jane Grey." And anyway, And anyway, they said, there's no question that according to the rules of heredity and according to the will of Henry VIII, Mary is the proper ruler. And so almost without any struggle at all, they simply took over and made Mary queen. And so Mary Tudor became Queen of England. And so we'll call E the reign of Mary. The reign of Mary. And this is from 1553 to 1558, 5 years. And in the providence of God, the fact that Mary became queen and that she reigned for 5 years was a great thing for the advance of Protestants. If Mary had reigned 30 years instead of 5, it probably would have meant the utter destruction of Protestantism in England. But at this time, the Jesuit order had little more than been started. There were no great number of highly trained Romanist ecclesiastics ready to establish a system of learning, advancing their views. And the popes had only begun to realize the importance of the situation shortly before this time. And most important of all, Mary only lived 5 years after she became king in the providence of God. That was tremendously important for the future development of English religion. Well, Mary, I'll give you subheads under this. I had some under Edward, but I didn't mention them. I discussed them all, but I didn't enumerate them. But under the reign of Mary, we'll make number one, accession of the queen. Number one, accession of the queen. And we've already noticed how there was very little difficulty about Mary becoming queen. Most of the people wanted her to be queen. This foolish hereditary idea was established all over the world at that time. And she was the next in line. There was no question of that. She became queen. Everybody wanted, or the bulk of people wanted to be loyal to her, except the Protestant leaders were filled with terror, some of them not knowing what she might do. Now, some of them fled to the continent. Some of them immediately left. There were perhaps 800 people in all, including a number of bishops and a number of a few priests, a number of bishops, a number of writers, various leaders who fled to the continent. I don't know if they all fled immediately, but in the course of the first year, a good many of them escaped. They went to various cities on the continent. There was a large group of them in Frankfurt, in Germany. There was another large group in Geneva. John Knox was invited to become the pastor of the group in Frankfurt, but he decided instead to go to Geneva. There he became the pastor of the English church, and he studied with Calvin. And though he was 10 years older than Calvin, he looked up to Calvin as his great leader, and he always treated Calvin with great deference, for he recognized that though Knox was a great Reformation leader, he was not of the stature of Calvin. Calvin was a great mind, and Knox had tremendous regard for him and learned much from him. But there were these people who fled to the continent. There were a good many others who said no. They said, we believe in the law that the ruler is the king, is the supreme head of the church. As Henry VIII established, in fact, those terms had been used long before Henry VIII. It wasn't that Henry VIII being made head of the church was new. It was that he being made head of the church to the exclusion of the Pope was new. They said, this has been English law for a long time. We believe it's true. Mary is now the head of the church. We are ready, whatever is legally done, we are ready to stand in line with it. But Mary was determined to reestablish the Roman cause. Now, immediately she got in touch with her cousin, Charles V, the emperor. Charles V had his ambassador in England all these years. His ambassador, who had kept him as close touch as he could with Catherine, tried to help. Charles gave her advice. He says, go slowly. Now go slowly. Don't get people all excited. Don't cause rebellion. Move slowly. Bring the English people to complete subjection to the Roman Church, but don't move in such a way as to arouse great opposition and antagonism. He urged these things upon her. He even offered to give her his son in marriage to help her in it. Unfortunately for him, his son, Philip, who became king of Spain, Philip II of Spain, didn't have his father's quality of moving carefully and cautiously. He was one who was an extreme fanatic, but he was a young man, not as fanatic, but quite a little more tactful now than he became in later years. So this was the first problem. We'll call number two, reestablishment of the Roman power. And we will mention as a small a the first problem that caused trouble to the English people. That was the Queen's marriage. The Queen's marriage. Charles offered that his son, Philip II, king who was to be king of Spain, became so within the next couple of years, that Philip II would marry his second cousin, Mary of England. And Mary was very happy about this. She was 38, already worn and aged by grief and care. He was only 27. She adored him, but he almost loathed her. And he made her miserable by neglect and unfaithfulness. The purpose of the marriage, of course, was to aid in the restoration of Catholicism. An Englishman who was a cardinal, he had to flee to Rome because he was related to Henry VIII, and therefore Henry might have thought of him as a potential danger to the throne. So he'd been in danger during Henry's life. But he was a cardinal and a man generally considered of quite high character, Cardinal Pole. Cardinal Pole, who later came to England, Cardinal Pole said, "As Christ, being heir of the world, was sent down by his father from the royal throne to be at once spouse and son of the Virgin Mary, and to be made the comforter and savior of mankind, so in like manner the greatest of all princes upon earth," that's Philip II, "the heir of his father's kingdom," as Charles V, "departed from his own broad and happy realm, that he too might come hither into this land of trouble to be the spouse and son of this Virgin Mary, to aid in the reconciliation of this people to Christ and the Church." That's the way Cardinal Pole expressed the coming of Philip II to Mary, Queen of England. The English people felt quite differently. Many of them who were very loyal to Mary were very disgusted at her marrying the man who was just becoming King of Spain. And the King Philip brought with him a number of leaders in the Spanish Church, some of whom were declaring that there should be established an Inquisition and there should be established punishment for all who didn't conform to the Roman Church. Others of whom, feeling exactly the same way, preached belief in tolerance while telling others they're just doing this to keep from the people from causing uprising and to keep them contented until they could get into real power. But there were many people in England who felt they didn't want England to just be a subject country to Spain, and they were quite offended at her marriage, which meant so very much to her. He came over to England, married her, stayed a few months, and he went back to Spain. She constantly longed for him to come back and wrote letters to him, and when she felt she was going to have a child, she announced she was going to have one, was so happy and was so disappointed when it proved not to work out. But it was a great sorrow for her wife that he wouldn't move to stay in England permanently with her, but he stayed a number of months. But now there was another problem. Small A was the church, Queen's marriage. Small B is the question of the former church property. And in the providence of God, here was an economic matter which proved to be important in the preservation of Protestantism in England. Henry had seized the little monasteries, and then he seized all the rest of the monasteries, and most of these he'd either given to his favorites or sold to them, And Henry was quite generous, a good bit of a spendthrift. He often sold them at rather low rates, forgiven them. Many of them had sold them for a lot more than what they had paid him for. Now this land was held by various English people. And of course, Mary said, this is property that belongs to the church. It should immediately be given back to the church and all the monasteries we established. But when you had a couple of thousand people owning this property, most of them having purchased it and paid money for it to somebody else, you had a really tough problem. And though the Parliament was ready to do what Mary wanted on most things, and when Mary asked them to reestablish the laws for punishment of heretics, they passed the law she asked. And when she asked them to do away with the prayer books and the Protestant things that Edward's reign had been introduced, they voted to do away with it. But when she asked them to have all the monastic property, former church property, given back to the church, they absolutely refused. And no matter how hard she tried, she couldn't persuade the Parliament to do it. And with this problem, the Pope said this property must be given back. But Cardinal Pole knew how the English people felt on this. It was suggested he come as a representative to England of the Pope. He said, we are going to have just trouble in England if I cannot go and say that the Pope agreed to this property remaining in the hands of the people who have it now. And finally, the Pope agreed to that. And so when Cardinal Pole came to England, he was able to announce that the church property that Henry seized and sold, and much has been resold, that is not going to be interfered with. Well, that, of course, made it easier for the time being, but it did not allow the reestablishment of all this force of monasteries all through the land that Mary wanted. So it's doubtful if it could have been done anyway in the short time she had. Well, then, small c, the papal legate Cardinal Pole. Pole was a man who had belonged to a group in Rome who, shortly after beginning the Reformation, met together for development of the spiritual life. He was devoted to the Pope, devoted to most of the Romanist doctrine. He knew English life and English thought. He was an ideal man to send as papal legate to England. He came in about the second year of Mary's reign, and during the rest of the reign, it was Mary and Cardinal Pole working together, determined to establish Romanism in England. They D is the martyrdom. And the attempt used to be made by those who thought that all the monarchs, of course, were about perfect and shouldn't be blamed for anything, to make out that it was Cardinal Pole and the leaders who had the martyrdom, and that Mary actually wasn't for that sort of thing. But careful investigation of the document has, within the last century, convinced also that actually Mary was the one who was determined to have the martyrdom. Well, that may have been partly due to the attitude of her husband, Philip II, because when Philip II wanted to celebrate a great victory or a happy wedding in his family or some great occasion, he always tried to have them have three or four Protestants or others who they could burn at the stake that he could watch as part of the celebration. He was extreme in his fanaticism. In fact, thousands, perhaps tens of thousands of people in the Netherlands died on account of his attempt to enforce Romanism in the Netherlands, and it resulted eventually in Spain losing Holland after about 40 years of constant fighting and bloodshed up there. But the queen was the force in England that pushed toward the martyrs. And the second of those who they see, the first was a prominent Bible translator named Rogers, but the second who was burned was Bishop Hooper. And they said, we will take him to the place where he has been bishop, so that the people in the area where he has been bishop will see what is the fate of those who turn against the truth. And so there they publicly burned Bishop Hooper. They had a ceremony at which a Romanist preached a long sermon on the truth of the Romanist doctrine. They filled up the faggots around. They lit them, and it was very inefficiently done. so that his legs burned to a crisp before any of the rest of his body was touched by the flame. So he had 45 minutes of terrible agony before it finally killed him. But during this, his own family was standing nearby, exhorting him to be faithful and trust the Lord and look to the Lord to give him the constancy to stand true through it. And the people around, most of them, were sympathetic with the bishop, and their feelings of the truth of what he's been preaching was strengthened by seeing the way in which Bishop Hooper stood this terrible suffering for his faith. Now, there were altogether about 390 people burned at the stake during Mary's brief five-year reign. And most of these were people who had been very prominent before. When the order was given that all the churches must revert to Roman Catholic ceremonies, out of 9,000 priests in the churches in England, 2,000 refused to submit and lost their income and walked out of the church. But the other 7,000 proceeded to carry out whatever the regulations were. But 2,000 out of the 9,000 refused to submit. And in the meeting of representatives of the clergy, when they first were asked to stand for these doctrines, fully a third of them had argued strongly for Protestant doctrine. But some of the bishops had been seized, and they held public disputations in which they allowed them to present their views, but they had the opposite presented, and then the queen gave her judgment that the other side had won out in the debate, that they were proven wrong, and they ordered them to be removed from their position. And so two or three of the bishops were taken to Cambridge and burned there. Three of them were taken to Oxford. These three included Bishop Latimer and Ridley, two names I believe you are familiar with. Particularly Latimer, the one who had been won to Christ through Thomas Bilney's confessing to him. Latimer was a great preacher and had preached widely in England. He had often preached before the king. In fact, Cranmer once had given Latimer a little advice before he preached before Henry VIII on one occasion. He said, after an hour and a half, the king's apt to get a little bit restless. So I think it'd be wise if you didn't run your sermon longer than an hour and a half. But he was a preacher above the ordinary that Henry was willing to listen to him as long as an hour and a half. Well, Latimer and Ridley were taken to Oxford, and there in Oxford they were publicly burned. And as they stood there, Latimer said to Ridley, he said, by God's grace we will light a candle today that will never be put out. And the fire was lit. Latimer was over 70 now, and the flames, immediately the smoke came right into his face, and the flames, and he died almost instantly. But Ridley went through a long period of suffering, not as long as Hooper had, but a long period of misery, but he stood staunchly there for what he believed. Now a small e is Cranmer. Of all people, Mary hated Cranmer, because Cranmer was the one, as we've seen, who had given Henry the advice, if the Pope wouldn't give him a divorce, to go to the universities and ask their opinion and to assert his own power in England, is over against the Pope. And Cranmer had been the Archbishop of Canterbury. Now, Cranmer's life is a little hard for us to evaluate today. Cranmer is not a man who stood up and said, this is what I believe, no matter what happens. He was a timid man. He was a man who was very much afraid of physical suffering. He was a scholar there at the Cambridge University, quietly conducting his tutorship. He gave this suggestion to somebody. They passed it on to Henry. He had great awe of the king. He never would go against the king. And so the king said to Cranmer, now I want you to be archbishop. I don't want any question of your authority. So he said, you must certify that you are accepting this position from the Pope, and that you recognize the Pope as the supreme head and the supreme authority in the church. So this is before they declared Henry entirely free of the Pope. And Cranmer said, how can I sign a thing like that? I don't believe the Pope has power over the Christ's kingdom. Well, Henry said, you write out a statement then to that effect. that you believe that the Pope really doesn't have any power. You're just signing this form because that's the proper form to sign in becoming Archbishop of Canterbury. You write out this statement in advance and you sign it, and it'll be all right. Well, Cranmer sort of hates it. Well, Henry said, I command you to do it. You believe in the divine right of kings. You believe my authority. No, you don't. So Cranmer signed it. So Cranmer signed the statement, and the Pope, unable to give Henry the divorce for fear of Charles V, was glad to appoint the man Henry wanted as Archbishop of Canterbury, the other one having just died. And so Cranmer was made Archbishop of Canterbury by the papal order. And then when the English Church, English Parliament declared that it was wrong for any Englishman to look to an outside man outside of England as an authority, and they fined the English Church for having done so, and they made them all certify that Henry was the head of the Church in every way, Cranmer continued as Archbishop of Canterbury. And then toward the end of the reign, when Henry was persecuting Protestants, one of the bishops brought an order when Henry was out of the country that Cranmer be seized for heresy. But as soon as Henry heard of it, he quashed that particular order. And Cranmer managed to keep through all the terms and with on good terms with Henry. And then when Henry was gone and Edward VI was king, Cranmer was the leader in the great progress towards the Reformation. And now Mary was queen, and Cranmer said, you are the queen, you're the head of the church, of course, I'm subject to you. Well, she says, you have done what is wrong, you should be in prison for it. So they put Cranmer in prison. And then they said, they sent someone to Cranmer, and they said, the queen doesn't want you to be hurt. Now, you just publicly declare that you believe that she is the head of the church, has the authority over the church. You give us a public statement. Plus, Cranmer always believed the power of the English monarch head of the church, so he signed the statement. Then they came to him and they said to Bishop Cranmer, they said, Mary'd like a little stronger statement than this, she said. She would like you to say that you made a mistake formerly in Edward VI's reign in pushing things against the Pope, that you feel that she is right in what she's doing. Well, Cranmer signed that. And they gave him one paper after another, seven papers in all, each one a little stronger than the other. And when it got toward the latter ones, and he heard of what happened to Latimer, and what happened to Ridley, and what happened to Hooper and the others, he signed a statement which went back on practically everything he had stood for. And then they had him out in a public meeting where one of the Romanists gave a great speech on against the marriage of the clergy and in favor of transubstantiation and these other matters. And they had him at this public meeting, and they tried to show everybody how that's the way that Cranmer stood. But they said, Cranmer has in the past done that which is wicked. And so they said, we are going to remove his robe from him. And going to give him the punishment that he deserved for it. They could not hurt Cranmer until they had an order from Rome, because the Pope had made him Archbishop. He couldn't be punished until the Pope revolted. So they got the order from Rome. And they ordered Cranmer to give publicly his statement that he had signed. And Cranmer looked at the crowd, and he felt ashamed of what he had done for in his fear. And he declares, I, through fear, have done what is wrong. Actually, he said, the Mass is an idolatry. There's nothing in the Scripture against priests marrying. He went ahead and he gave a ringing testimony. And they were so upset with that, they said, well, we were planning to burn you next week, but we'll do it this week. So they took him out and they put him on they fastened him to the stake, and they put the faggots around him, and this timid man, who had all his life been afraid of torture, afraid of any kind of pain, turned to the crowd, and he said, through fear, I signed a statement going against what I believe. And he said, this hand here is the hand that did it. And he said, I regret it so much that this hand I'm going to destroy. And he reached out and held his hand and arm in the flames until the hand and arm was completely burnt. And then the flames engulfed him, and he was burned. But the effect of these burnings of these 390 people on the people of England was to make them see the constancy of the reformers and to see how even a man like Cranmer, who was ordinarily so timid, would at the end there stand for what he believed in so strongly. And if Mary had another 30 years to teach Romanism, to destroy all spreading of Protestant books, England would have become, as they succeeded in doing in Pole. But Archbishop Pole and Mary both died within a few hours of each other. And shortly before this, the new Pope, Paul IV, had been suspicious of Pole because he made some statements that sounded a little like justification by faith and had revoked Pope's power to be vicar in England and was ordering him to come back to Rome for examination. But Pole died and Mary died, and the 5 years that she was reigned was seen in the providence of God, springs from the Protestant movement, where 30 years of her reign would probably have destroyed Mr. Varner. That's that. C-O-L-E. Yeah. Well, then we come to F. We come to F, which is the victory of English Protestantism under Queen Elizabeth. The victory of English Protestantism under Queen Elizabeth. Now here, number one, the religious situation. When Elizabeth became queen, the great bulk of the people of England for 5 years had the same old ceremonies as before. The bulk of the people were uneducated, knew very little about it. There was a strong group of people that had been greatly moved by the death, by the persecution, who had an inclination toward Protestantism. Probably the bulk of the educated people were moving toward Protestantism. At least two-thirds of the nobility were devoted to Roman Catholicism, as far as they were to anything. Elizabeth then came into a situation with a somewhat divided country, and people weren't quite sure what she would do. If Elizabeth had chosen to follow in the footsteps of her sister Mary, without the persecution, she probably could have taken the country back to Romanism. She probably could have. She was considered as having almost absolute power, and she was in a very dangerous situation because most of the countries of Europe were against Protestantism in England, and many of them considered her as illegitimate, considered the divorce from Catherine as not having been valid, considered that Anne Boleyn, therefore, was not Henry's wife, and Elizabeth was, therefore, not properly a queen. She was in a very, very difficult situation. But people wondered what Elizabeth would do. There was a unanimity among the people that Elizabeth was next to be queen. She didn't have much more trouble or any more trouble than Mary. But there was one difference. Mary was a dour woman that people wanted to be queen. She was next in line, but she didn't have much of Henry's charm. Elizabeth had all of Henry's. And this young girl of 25, when she came to England, to London to be crowned, she knew just what to say and just what to do to please people. She had tremendous charm, tremendous personal ability. She spoke 7 or 8 languages fluently. She was highly educated. She was a very, very able young woman. And when they had the ceremony her being crowned, she carried a small copy of a portion of the Bible in her hand, which surprised people, and which was just a quiet way of seeming to say, I am on the side of the Protestants. Was the law, Parliament had passed the Romanist law. She did nothing of her own initiative. She was like her father. She made Parliament do so before she did anything in the way of law. So for the first few months, the Romanist ceremonies were all continued. And Elizabeth continued as they were, but gradually she began to move in a Protestant direction. Now we'll make number two, the problem facing the queen. The problems facing the queen. These were very tough problems. The bishops were unanimously in favor of Romanism. Mary had seen to that. They had gotten rid of all the Protestant bishops. Mary had a church which was, the leadership of which was solidly against, or Elizabeth had, which was solidly against Protestantism, and three-fourths of the nobility were in favor of Romanism, and many of the Romanist leaders felt that Elizabeth was not the legitimate queen. Well, she faced a situation in which it would have been easy to have fallen into a great difficulty or danger. But Elizabeth had a remarkable preparation for her position. Whether Elizabeth was a sincere Protestant, whether she was even a Christian, has been greatly debated. I have a book here by an English churchman who says some things about her that makes you wonder about her character very much. But of her charm, there's no question. Of her ability, there's no question. And of the fact that she enabled the Protestant leaders to change England from a country that was predominantly Romanist to a country that was predominantly Protestant during her reign. And that she protected England during that time so that the great attack which might have come when she became queen in 1558 did not come till 1588, 30 years later. And when it did come, and Philip II sent his great armada against England, and all the forces of Europe felt that this armada would succeed and Philip would conquer England, Elizabeth had put it off for 30 years, during which time she had trained English freebooters to become great sailors, and had secretly made preparations and had won the loyalty of the English and prepared them in such a way that even though it is generally considered that the divine providence had a good bit to do with the defeat of the armada, humanly speaking, if the armada had come earlier, it would seem as if it would have been almost certain to have conquered England. But Elizabeth was a matchless politician, and she had a tremendous influence on the preservation of Protestantism in England. Her leading supporters were all Protestants, and she allowed them a good deal of power and force, and allowed the gospel to be widely preached. Well, we'll have to stop there. We'll continue.